This audio recording is presented by Jews for Judaism. We are dedicated to keeping Jews Jewish. www.jewsforjudaism.ca.
A couple of years ago, a friend of mine was nudging me to read this book, The Da Vinci Code, and wanted to know what I thought about it. And I really was reluctant. I said, first of all, I haven't read a novel since I was about 12 years old, which is true. And I said, why would I want to read this? I spend so much time every week, every day, studying the real accounts of this, nonfiction works, really much more than I would like to. So why should I bother myself with a work of fiction? So I really didn't read the book. I'm not coming here tonight without having read it. I was on the internet last week and I saw that a rabbi had the chutzpah to review the book without having even seen the movie, certainly didn't even read the book. But over Passover, I did finally read this book, and I actually saw the movie on the day that it debuted. And one of the things I've been wondering about is how it's possible for a novel that's basically a murder mystery scavenger hunt that really has no real character development. I mean, most of us read novels, good novels, for character development. And really a very thin plot that's essentially one long, very long chase scene. How it's possible for a novel like this to become such an incredible cultural phenomenon. You just think about it. The 60 million, I believe, already sold in 44 languages. Dozens and dozens of spin-off products and tours to the locations. I saw when I was in the airport this Passover a Leonardo da Vinci diet book. If you could believe it. I think that part of the appeal is that even though this is a novel, it does claim to reveal an actual conspiracy that has concealed the true story of Christianity that could really undermine the entire church today. And I believe that in an age of cynicism, where many people don't trust power brokers of organized religion, this book has tremendous appeal, especially among people that were raised in Christian homes, who are wondering, what haven't they told us? And I believe there's a tremendous thirst and a tremendous curiosity for knowledge, and I believe people really do want to know. Now, for the two or three of you who have not read the book or seen the movie, I'll just briefly share with you what some of the major revelations are, not the storyline so much, but what are the serious claims that Dan Brown makes in this book and claims that these are actually true. He claims this is not fiction. He claims the fictional story is based around these truths. For example, Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, who was later painted by the church to be a prostitute. And they had a child named Sarah. And this child became the progenitor of a line of French monarchs, and that this bloodline still exists today. Da Vinci Code reveals that the Holy Grail is not really a chalice. It's not the vessel, the cup that Jesus had at the Last Supper, but the Holy Grail is really a metaphor for Mary Magdalene herself and her bloodline. The Da Vinci Code insists that the historical church has been aggressively trying to conceal all of this knowledge from the world, and in the process has been trying to stamp out feminine spirituality. It's one of the reasons this book has such an appeal to women in the world today. The Da Vinci Code claims that the Christian Bible, and really Christianity as we know it, was really foisted upon the world by Constantine, in the beginning of the 4th century to further his own selfish agenda, and that he really displaced all of the real, original stories of Christianity that are today only preserved in Gnostic texts. And finally, probably the most significant claim that Dan Brown makes is that Jesus' secret bloodline has been protected by an ancient organization called the Priory of Zion, which allegedly has its roots going all the way back to the times of the Bible, and its members continue over the course of history to conceal secret clues about these truths in works of literature and art, such as Leonardo da Vinci's paintings, even in the Walt Disney movies that we grew up with. These were all concealing the truth about the real story of Jesus and Christianity. Now, as you can imagine, church leaders have been very, very distressed, not just by the contents of this book, but by the very serious impact it's been having among Christians. There are many polls that have revealed that about 25% of the Christians reading this book say that it's had a tremendous impact upon their spirituality and what they believe are to be the truths of their faith. One Christian magazine called Christianity Today had a cover story called Da Vinci Fever. If you can see in the back there, how to fight the infection. Now, I must admit that Christian scholars and researchers have done diligent work investigating the facts and the claims of the Da Vinci Code. They have submitted it to a CSI-like investigation, and they've really been able to puncture it very thoroughly. They found, for example, hundreds of simple factual errors. The Da Vinci Code claims, for example, that in the late Middle Ages, the church burned over 5 million witches at the stake. It's a large number of people. It's hard to imagine how Europe even populated itself. But among scholars and historians that have actually studied this period, the estimate ranges about 30 to 80,000 maximum. That's a very huge disparity. And it's hard to imagine how Dan Brown gets this number of over 5 million. And Christian scholars and analysts subjected the Da Vinci Code to microscopic analysis, finding endless minutiae of errors. For example, the pyramid outside the Louvre doesn't have 666 panes of glass. It's a little bit less than that. Or people wondering, was it really possible for the crazed albino monk Silas to shoot someone from across the room at night when albinos have very difficult time seeing at night? Or really, when someone gets shot in the stomach, do they only last 15 minutes? And hundreds of questions about the accuracy of this book and film. I want to share with you just some of the more serious problems, both historical and doctrinal. First of all, the most serious problem with the Da Vinci Code is that its central foundational claim is based upon a total fiction. The code claims that the Priory of Zion is the oldest secret society in the world. It is a cult of secret goddess worshippers who preserve the ancient Gnostic wisdom about the secrets of Jesus and his bloodline. And indeed, and this is actually true, in France, a number of decades ago, documents did turn up in the French National Library from the Priory of Zion, listing its leading grandmasters over history, including such great people as Sir Isaac Newton, Leonardo da Vinci, the famous artist Botticelli, Victor Hugo. And the Da Vinci Code, as well as its predecessor, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, based their entire thesis on this organization called the Priory of Zion. However, French investigative journalists noticed that there was no record of who deposited these records in the National Library in France. Normally, anything that's submitted or held in record has a record of who put it there, how it came there. There's no record of who deposited these records. So the French investigative journalists discovered that indeed there was an organization called the Priory of Zion that was registered with the government of France in 1956. And it was organized by a very, very shady character named Pierre Plantard. And Plantard borrowed the name of an actual Catholic monastic order that started in the year 1100 and lasted until the year 1617. Now, this Plantard was an ultra-conservative anti-Semite who had an obsession with reuniting all of Europe under the Roman Catholic Church, plus a monarchy that would descend from the line of Jesus and Mary. And he fancied himself a descendant of this line, obviously had delusions of grandeur. So what Plantard did was to, with a number of associates, fabricate these documents about the Priory of Zion and all of their grandmasters, and they had them placed around different places in France. Ultimately, the investigative journalist discovered that these documents were printed on the exact same printing press that published Plantard's ultra-nationalistic and anti-Semitic newsletters and broadsides. Ultimately, in the 1980s, his co-conspirators and even he himself confessed to the fact that these are forgeries and confessed to the fact that everything was totally made up. Checkmate to the Da Vinci Code. On theological grounds as well, Christians have discovered many very serious problems. For example, Dan Brown writes that the marriage of Mary Magdalene to Jesus is a matter of historical record. Now, when you make a claim like that, it would obviously be helpful to have some kind of evidence if it's a matter of historical record. But the fact of the matter is there is absolutely no historical evidence whatsoever that Jesus was married to anyone. For example, there are two arguments that Brown makes in the Da Vinci Code. Number one, he says that as a Jewish man living in Israel 2,000 years ago, it would have been unimaginable for Jesus to be unmarried. Every man was married. Now, obviously, most Jewish men did get married, but it is not true to say that Jewish men were all married and that they had to all get married. We know from the Talmud that Ben Azai was not married. We know there was an entire sect of Jews at the time of Jesus called the Essenes who didn't marry. So this argument is very, very weak. Secondly, Brown cites an apocryphal Gospel of Philip, which says that Mary was Jesus' companion. And Dan Brown says, and he has this lay Teabing speaking on his behalf, that the Aramaic word for companion is really spouse. And therefore, Mary was not just his companion, she was his spouse. And the problem is that the Gospel of Philip was not a work that was written in Aramaic. It was a Coptic document. And the word here for companion was actually borrowed from the Greek. And the Greek word simply means companion with no possible association to the word spouse. Another problem in the Da Vinci Code is that Dan Brown insists that the Dead Sea Scrolls were actually the oldest Christian documents. Now again, here is a total blunder, because the Dead Sea Scrolls are documents that have absolutely no mention of Jesus and nothing at all to do with Christianity. They are the documents of a Jewish sect with no connection at all to the early story of Christianity. Another problem with the Da Vinci Code is that Dan Brown casts Constantine as the great villain who ultimately calls the Council of Nicaea in the year 325, and he uses this council to push forward an agenda to radically transform the real religion of Christianity. And Dan Brown makes two interesting points. he says that, first of all, until the Council of Nicaea, no one considered Jesus to be divine. Jesus was considered to be simply a human prophet, a human being, but it was at the time of Constantine where they wanted to displace the feminine goddess that they ultimately promoted Jesus to being the God. Now, the problem with this claim is that, in truth, followers of Jesus and Christians had already been believing that he was divine for several centuries before the Council of Nicaea. And when they came to this council, the only question was not so much whether or not Jesus was divine, but rather how to understand his divinity. Was he a created being, or was he co-eternal with God? But either way, the idea that Christians only began to believe that Jesus is divine at Nicaea in 325 is false. Brown also claims that the vote at this council was very, very close. Yet the true vote was that out of the 300 delegates, only two of them didn't vote to accept the final proposals. Dan Brown also says that at the Council of Nicaea, the official today's Christian canon was finally accepted, meaning the books that we have in the New Testament today were finally codified and canonized with the Council of Nicaea. This is also totally untrue. The canonization of the Christian scriptures, the Greek scriptures that we have today, was a long process that took place between the 2nd and 6th centuries. It wasn't even finished by the Council of Nicaea. And finally, one more problem is that Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code insist that the most accurate and the most truthful statements and teachings and records that we have about Jesus and Christianity were preserved in the Gnostic literature as opposed to the canonical Christian literature that we have today. The problem with this statement is very simple. According to almost all scholars, the books of the Christian Bible that we have today were essentially written between the year 70 and the year 150. By the middle of the second century, basically all of the Christian biblical texts that we have today were written. However, the Gnostic texts that Dan Brown bases himself upon were written between the 2nd and the 4th centuries. These are much later documents. So to say that these much later documents are more accurate and more historical and more reliable is very, very difficult. Now I want to ask another question. Is a Da Vinci Code only a concern for Christians? You know, they tell a cute story that a preacher got up in front of his church and he announced to everyone very sternly, he said, "Someday, everyone in this parish is going to die." And there's a little old man in the back, and he's giggling and he's laughing. And the preacher is a little bit stunned by this. So he finally walks over to the old little man, and he says, "What are you laughing about?" And the old man says, "I'm not from this parish." So the truth is that Dan Brown takes his claims about the sacred feminine, and he really takes them all the way back to our Bible. Let me share with you. The Da Vinci Code says the following. The early Jews believed that the Holy of Holies in the Temple of Jerusalem housed not only God, but his powerful female equal, the Shekhinah. And men who were seeking spiritual wholeness came to the temple to visit with holy priestesses in order to experience the divine through sexual union with these priestesses in the temple. Now, I went to Yeshiva University for 9 years. I never learned this one. Anyone that reads this, you know, that has a little bit of understanding, realizes how far off this is. That in truth, the Shekhinah is not a goddess. The Shekhinah is our way of expressing the immanence of God in this world, the divine presence. Now, Brown might be referring to a number of stories in our Tanakh. Our scriptures do speak about a number of times when there were periodic intrusions of Canaanite idolatrous practices into Jerusalem. It happens once or twice. It's mentioned in the book of Kings. And these are clearly not normative Jewish practice, as Brown would have us believe. This is not what Judaism was all about. These are clearly aberrations. The Bible, in many, many places, specifically teaches against these kind of practices. And we see in the Bible itself, as soon as they're mentioned, we're told that Asa or Josiah, these great righteous Jewish kings, they stamped out these practices. This was not something that was acceptable among Jews. Now again, the Da Vinci Code postulates that there was a real story of Christian origins that's been covered up. And as we've seen, the major problem with Dan Brown's thesis is that over the past several hundred years, there have been hundreds of very serious scholars, both Christian and non-Christian, who have done painstaking research into the history of Christianity, people specializing in the field of Christian origins. And they have unearthed, in all of these years, not one shred of evidence that supports the far-fetched and half-baked truths that Dan Brown puts forward. And that's one of the sad facts about this book and this movie, is that it raises the possibility that there really was a story that's been concealed, but it's such a poor straw man that's held up, it's so easily knocked down, I think that many people might just walk away from the whole issue altogether. But what I wanted to share tonight was the following. There has been an emerging sense among many scholars that indeed there was a real history of Christianity that has been concealed from the very beginning. There is a real story that's been covered up. And this real story is much more interesting than Dan Brown's story. First of all, because it's possibly true. And truth is always much more interesting than fiction. And unlike Dan Brown's story, this possible alternative history of Christianity has a lot of very solid scholarship behind it. It's not conclusive, and I don't want to give the impression that what I'm sharing tonight is the final chapter of the story, but I want to assure you that many scholars, both Jewish and Christian, are beginning to head in this direction. And what I'd like to do to give you a peek under the curtain about some of this scholarship is to look at the lives of three very important people in the early history of Christianity. Mary, the wife of Joseph, the mother of Jesus. Because Christianity sees Jesus as the incarnate God, many Jewish people don't understand this. They say, no, Christians don't believe Jesus is God. They just believe he's the Son of God, as if the Son of God is not God in Christian terms. No, let me assure you that essentially Orthodox Christian belief across the board understands that Jesus was God in the flesh. They worship Jesus as God. And because of this, Mary has been seen by many, many Christians, primarily in the Catholic world, as the Mother of God. At some responsibility. Because of this idea, and I don't want to be ridiculing it, I just want to look at it for a few minutes. Because of this idea that Mary is supposedly the mother of God, there are a number of important Christian doctrines that developed. One is the Catholic idea called the Immaculate Conception, which is often confused with the virgin birth doctrine. The Immaculate Conception means that Mary herself was born without being tainted by original sin, meaning that she herself was totally immaculate of the stain of any sin. She's sinless, and that's why she's able to give birth to God. Obviously, there's the Christian belief in the virgin birth of Jesus. Jesus was not born to a human father. Christians believe that that Mary was impregnated by the Holy Spirit of God Himself. Now, we know, again, as Jews, that the New Testament tries to show that there is textual basis for this from our Hebrew Bible. They quote a verse in the 7th chapter of Isaiah, where they translate the verse talking about a virgin. And we know now, not just among Jews, but even Christian scholars admit this is a mistranslation. And finally, again, among Catholics, but even among some Protestants, there's the doctrine not only of the virgin birth of Jesus, but of the perpetual virginity of Mary. That even after Jesus was born, Mary had no relations with Joseph, her husband. They never had relations. They never had children. They basically view Mary as a woman totally disconnected from a normal contextual life of a Jewish woman living in Israel 2,000 years ago. But is it possible that Mary's real story is much more pedestrian than this? In fact, the contours of a very different story emerge very subtly from the pages of the Christian Bible itself. There's a genealogy given of Jesus in the book of Matthew, chapter 1, the very first chapter of the Christian Bible. And this genealogy traces Jesus all the way back to King David. And interestingly, it doesn't only mention men in this genealogy. You know, when you go through the biblical begats, right? He begat, he begat, he begat. It's a long list of men. But in the genealogy of Matthew, there were four women that are inserted into the genealogy. Four women that are just mentioned by the way. And of these four women, all of them had lives that included a story of some kind of sexual scandal. Sexual relations out of wedlock, sometimes resulting in children being born. But one wonders, why does Matthew list these four women before getting to Mary? Another thing that happens in the Christian Bible is that there are clear rumors of Jesus' illegitimacy, meaning that Mary had Jesus and there was a human father. Strange that might sound. That there was a human father and it wasn't her husband Mary. And it wasn't her husband Joseph. So that would have been cute. That's the next Dan Brown novel. Mary marries herself. So where do we see these hints? Hints of the illegitimacy of Jesus. So one is very interesting. In the book of Mark, chapter 6, someone sees Jesus and says, "Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary?" Now that sounds strange because usually, again, you identified someone by who their father is. It should say, "Isn't this the carpenter, the son of some guy?" But it simply says, "Isn't this the carpenter, the son of Mary?" And the reader is left wondering, who's the father? So when Matthew, and Matthew is written several decades later, when Matthew reframes this story, listen carefully to what Matthew says. Someone sees Jesus and says, Is this not the carpenter's son? Is this not the carpenter's son? Giving the impression that there's a man who is the father of Jesus. And is not his mother called Mary? So we see a subtle rewriting, a reframing of the earlier stories to take away the edge from the implication that maybe something isn't kosher with Jesus' background. In the book of John, which is the last of the Gospels, it's even clearer. Jesus is in one scene confronting some of his opponents, and they say to him, they throw a very low blow, and they say to him, "We were not born of fornication." The implication is, "But you were." So we have these textual hints in the Christian Bible that maybe Jesus did have an earthly father, but not the one that was married to Mary. Now, some of you probably know that there were ancient rumors floating around that The father of Jesus was a Roman soldier named Pantera. The earliest expression of this rumor is, I think, expressed by the pagan philosopher Celsus. Celsus, in about the year 176, wrote a book about Christianity, critiquing Christianity, and he suggests this possibility that the father of Jesus was this Roman soldier named Pantera. Now, it's interesting that in several Talmudic and rabbinic and midrashic sources, these are Jewish sources, going back before Celsus to the first century, they do speak about someone named Yeshua bar Pantera, Jesus the son of Pantera, who lived in the Galilee. Interesting. What happens in later Christian sources, because later Christian sources already knew about these rumors. So some of them try to deal with by saying, well, you see, Joseph's father was named Jacob ben Pantera. They try to push it off to Joseph's father. Or some say that Mary's great-grandfather was named Pantera. But clearly there's a concern about this Pantera rumor. Now, the name Pantera does show up in Latin documents, especially when it lists Roman soldiers. So the idea that there were Roman soldiers and they had the name Pantera wasn't so strange back then. Interestingly, we know that some Jewish people had the name Pantera as well. They found caves in the Jerusalem area where Jews have this name Pantera. Now, James Tabor, in his very important recent work called The Jesus Dynasty, tries to track down this Pantera rumor. And he cites the research of an Adolf Deismann from the year 1906, who actually found a tombstone in Germany of a Roman soldier named Tiberius Julius Abdes Pantera. Now, what's interesting about this tombstone is that it's the tombstone of a soldier who actually fought in Palestine in the first century. And he was from the city of Sidon, or some people call it Sidon, which is not that far from Nazareth. Studying his name, scholars determined that this Pantera was not a native-born Roman, but was probably a freed slave, certainly Semitic, and possibly even Jewish. And we know that Pantera's cohort of Roman soldiers came to the German Rhine to fight on the frontiers of the Roman Empire. They left Palestine in the year 9 CE. So the name seems correct. The date seems correct. The fact that he was very close to Nazareth seems correct. Do we know this is the grave of the father of Jesus? Not at all. But at least there's some kind of solid evidence upon which to base some thesis. It's not something that's plucked out of the air. One final curious point here. In the Gospel of Mark, which is the earliest of the New Testament Gospels, we're told that Jesus was teaching in the area of the Sea of Galilee. And all of a sudden, mittendrin, the Gospels tell us that Jesus takes a very strange and mysterious side trip, just out of nowhere. He takes a side trip to the area of Sidon and Tyre. And it says in chapter 7, verse 24, from there he arose and went away into the border of Tyre and Sidon, and he entered into a house and wanted no man to know of it. He went into the house, he didn't want anyone to know. And yet he could not escape notice. Now, all Christian commentaries struggle to know what's going on here. Why is he taking this strange trip to this area where there are no Jews? It's a Syrian city. And Jesus only taught Jews. So why is he schlepping to Sidon? It's a question mark. Let's move on to our next subject. I'm sure all of you have heard the name John the Baptist. Now, John the Baptist probably was not called John the Baptist when he was alive. He was probably called Yochanan HaMatbil. Yochanan HaMatbil. Yochanan the Immerser. Yochanan the dunker. Yochanan the guy that dunked people into the mikveh. That was his name. It wasn't John the Baptist. And When you say John the Baptist, it sounds like John the Presbyterian, right? You don't have any sense that it's referring to a real Jewish person who did a real Jewish thing. They turn him into a Christian from the 20th century, John the Baptist, John the Southern Baptist. It's bizarre. So who is this John the Baptist? So Josephus, who was a Jewish historian, writing at that time, Josephus reveals to us that John the Baptist was one of many apocalyptic preachers during the first century who actually was quite popular. He was so popular that in the Christian Bible, there are people who even approach him asking him, "Are you the Messiah?" That's how popular he was. People even thought he might have been the Messiah. What was the message of this Yohanan HaMatbil, John the Baptist? Actually, we should call him John the Baptizer, at least. Let's call him that, John the Baptizer. So his basic message was, the kingdom of God is at hand, which to any Jewish ears is very simple in terms of what it means. What it meant was that the present evil age, which is dominated by an evil Roman Empire, is soon coming to an end. And that the promised utopian redemption is right around the corner if we as Jews will repent, turn from our sinful ways, do tshuva, and symbolically purify ourselves by immersing ourselves in the Jordan River. That was the message of John the Baptizer. When Jesus was about 30 years of age, he joined the crowds of people who were streaming to hear John the Baptizer preach at the Jordan River. Jesus came to join the movement of John the Baptist. And he was baptized by this John the Baptizer. So Yochanan HaMatbil immerses Jesus into the Jordan River. But this subordination was very disturbing to the Christian church. Very disturbing. Now, there are four Christian Gospels. There are four basic stories of the life of Jesus. The Gospel of Mark is written in the year 70, about 40 years after the death of Jesus. The Gospel of Matthew is written in the 80s. The Gospel of Luke, a few years later. And finally, the Gospel of John, about the year 100. So the Christian texts basically are written between 40 and 70 years after the death of Jesus. Most contemporary scholars claim that there's an even earlier source that you can find embedded in the Gospel of Luke that they call the source Q. Now, if we study these five sources in their chronological order, you'll find something fascinating that takes place in the story of Yohanan HaMatbil. And you'll see how Yohanan HaMatbil can become John the Baptist. First of all, in the Q source, which comes from the book of Luke chapter 7, Jesus says about John the Baptizer, he's not just a prophet, he's more than a prophet. And Jesus goes on to say that among those born of women, there is no one greater than John. That's pretty laudatory. When we get to the book of Mark, again, the oldest of the four Gospels, Mark says that, listen carefully, Jesus came to be immersed. He came to be baptized by John. And then Jesus hears a voice from heaven which says, "You are my son, in whom I am well pleased." Jesus hears an internal voice. He hears a voice. It happens. But it's a private message. "You are my son." This is in Mark. So again, in Mark, Jesus comes to be baptized, and John the Baptizer immerses him in the Jordan River, and Jesus hears this message. He hears it in his ear. Matthew, which is written next, John doesn't want to baptize Jesus. He says, "I should baptize you. You should baptize me." Right? So Jesus says, "You're right. Technically, you're right. But for now, we'll do it this way. You can baptize me." So in Matthew, Jesus is reluctantly baptized by John the Baptizer. And in Matthew, there isn't a private message, "You are my son in whom I'm well pleased." In Matthew, there's a public announcement. "This is my son," right? Everyone should hear this now. "This is my son in whom I'm well pleased." In Matthew, the story is growing a little bit from a private message that Jesus hears to a public announcement over the loudspeaker. In the book of Luke, in the next story that's written, in the book of Luke, fascinating, Jesus immerses in the Jordan River, but there's no mention of John. No mention of him being baptized by John at this point. John is out of the story. He probably just does what most Jewish men do, is they immerse themselves. They baptize themselves. They don't need someone to baptize them. We're all capable of dunking under the water. But you see what's been happening over here. In the first source in Q, Jesus is praising John the Baptizer to the hilt. In the next source in Mark, Jesus comes to be baptized by him. In Matthew, John the Baptizer doesn't want to do it. And Jesus says, "Oh, you do it anyway." In Luke now, in Luke, there's no baptism of Jesus by John. And finally, when we get to the Gospel of John, there's no mention of Jesus being baptized at all. He's not baptized in this last story. Instead, John the Baptizer falls all over himself in praise of Jesus. "You are the Lamb of God. You take away the sins of the world. You must be the Son of God." He's literally tripping over himself with his praises of Jesus of Jesus. And yet in the earliest sources, it's Jesus that's praising John the Baptizer. So here we see a very fascinating development. In the earliest sources, there's prominence given to John the Baptizer. As a matter of fact, we even see stories in Q where Jesus learns the Lord's Prayer, that fame. I grew up in New York saying this in public school, right? So the Lord's Prayer, which we assume is from Jesus, the Q document in Luke tells us that Jesus actually learned it from John the Baptizer. John the Baptizer was his teacher, his Rebbe. That was the movement that Jesus was joining. The Christian writings can't have that. So as they go through their development of this story, the roles are switched. John the Baptizer becomes a gurnished, a nothing, and Jesus is elevated to the very top. One last personality. James. He wasn't called James when he was alive. He was called Yaakov. Now, if Mary was practically deified and John the Baptizer diminished, James meets the saddest fate of all. James is marginalized practically to the point of extinction. Now, this is ironic because many scholars insist that James is the critical link to uncovering the historical Jesus. If you want to know who Jesus was, find out who James was. Now, why is this true? And it may not be a coincidence that James is obscured so highly, specifically because he is the key to understanding Jesus. Now, when there was an ancient ossuary that was found in Israel several years ago, bearing the inscription, "James," or "Yaakov, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus." James, the son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus. This came to Toronto, by the way. It cracked on the way to Toronto. But it came to Toronto. When this happened, when this was discovered, it caused quite a stir in the world. Quite a stir. Most people were just simply totally shocked to find out Jesus had a brother? That was a shock to so many people. Because again, the story that crept into the consciousness of Christianity and then the world was that Mary was a perpetual virgin. She didn't have any other children. So to read about Jacob, this James, the brother of Jesus, was a very big shock. Now, who was this James? Who was Yaakov? He was known as James the Just. Now, that's an English word. A better translation would have been James the Righteous, Yaakov the Tzaddik. Who called him a tzaddik? there were Jewish Christian groups that persisted into the 2nd and 3rd and 4th centuries. They were called the Ebionites and the Nazarenes. These groups called James, James the Just, James the Righteous, because he was very Torah observant. He was very strict in his observance of the Torah. The second thing about this James, that's the most significant thing, is that he was the leader of the Jesus movement for 30 years after the death of Jesus. For 30 years after Jesus died, the head of the whole movement was this James, the brother of Jesus. And he was appointed the leader because of his great piety and because he was the brother of Jesus. Yet, in spite of this, this James is mysteriously downplayed and marginalized and pushed aside and ultimately forgotten. There is almost nothing ever written about James. You go to a library and try to find books about James more than 25 years old, good luck. James almost never appears in any ancient Christian art or iconography. Zilch, nothing. And yet he was the brother of Jesus who ran the church, ran the movement for 30 years until he himself was martyred. Now how did this happen? How is it possible that such an important leader was totally pushed aside? To understand this, we have to understand that many people are totally unaware of the incredible complexity and tensions that existed within the early Christian movement. Within the early Christian movement, the movement that followed Jesus of Nazareth, there was incredible complexity and tension. Most people simply assume that Jesus founded a new religion. He started a new religion called Christianity, and the rest just flew right out of that. It wasn't so simple. In the Christian scriptures, the four gospel stories, the four gospel biographies of Jesus, are followed by the book of Acts, A-C-T-S. Now, the book of Acts is actually called the Acts of the Apostles. The Acts of the Apostles. But what's incredible is that it practically says nothing about the apostles. It practically says nothing about the disciples and relatives of Jesus. It's almost all a book about Paul. Paul of Tarsus. Now, what's incredible is that Paul never met Jesus. However, he claims that Jesus revealed himself to Paul in a vision. Paul claims to have received a vision of the risen Jesus. But he never met Jesus. And more perplexing, he never goes and bothers to meet with the relatives and students of Jesus to find out anything about Jesus. He could have done that. Rather than stay in Jerusalem with the students and relatives and disciples of Jesus, Paul takes off for Greece and for Asia Minor to try to recruit Gentiles into the Jesus movement. Now, what was it that Paul was teaching? What did Paul teach? One thing that's fascinating, Paul virtually never mentions anything about the life of Jesus or about anything that Jesus taught. Shouldn't surprise us, he never met the man. But Paul practically says nothing about the life of Jesus or anything that Jesus taught. For Paul, and listen well, for Paul, the message that John the Baptizer and Jesus preached, the message that Jesus preached for Paul is transformed into the message of Jesus. For Paul, Jesus becomes the message. It's not about what Jesus taught. Jesus becomes the message for Paul. So for Paul, Jesus is a divine, supernatural, pre-existent being who took on human form to die on the cross as an atonement for those who would believe in him. Paul teaches that the Torah and its commandments are now totally irrelevant. And Paul redefines what it means to be a Jew. For Paul, to be an Israelite, to be a Jew, has nothing to do with your pedigree, with your genealogy. For Paul, a real Jew is someone who has faith in Jesus. This is what Paul is teaching among the Gentiles in Asia Minor and Greece. As you can imagine, there were tremendous tensions between Paul and the followers of Jesus who were back in Jerusalem. We have to understand that there was literally nothing that differentiated the followers of Jesus, like Peter and James, all of these people. There was nothing that differentiated them from other Jews at that time, other than their belief that Jesus was the promised Redeemer, and their faith, their belief that Jesus would come back soon to bring about the promised redemption. Otherwise, they didn't believe that the Torah was now irrelevant. They didn't believe that Jesus was God. They didn't believe that a Jew was someone who believed in Jesus. And they had tremendous difficulty with Paul. Most of their difficulty with Paul was over the issue of Torah observance. Almost all of the controversies in the book of Acts that we find between Paul and the rest of the believers in Jesus are about this topic of Torah observance. Paul comes back to Jerusalem in the 21st chapter of the book of Acts, and his colleagues from the Jerusalem church, from the followers of Jesus, they say, Paul, what are we hearing about you? That you're going around all over the exile teaching Jews and Gentiles not to keep the Torah. What is this? They can't believe it. However, in the year 70, Jerusalem is destroyed by the Romans, and many of these people that follow Jesus, many of these people in the Jesus movement based in Jerusalem, were killed, and the remainder of them were scattered throughout the world. And they became known as the Nazarenes and the Ebionites. And what's fascinating is that the conflicts between these Jewish followers of Jesus and Paul are also reflected very clearly in the writings of these later Jewish Christians, these later Jewish followers of Jesus, the Ebionites and the Nazarenes. For example, in the pseudo-Clementine literature, there's a book called The Preaching of Peter, where Peter complains that his letters are being distorted by followers of Paul. And he censures Paul. He criticizes Paul for placing his personal subjective visions over the clarity of what the people who were with Jesus actually learned from Jesus. He's saying, how can you, Paul, place your personal experiences, your revelations in some dream that basically do away with the entire Torah against what we learned from Jesus himself? We were with Jesus. We followed him for years. And as Paul's Gentile church grew, because again, Paul was operating in the Gentile world, his church grew, the Jewish group in Jerusalem diminished, it disappeared, and Paul's group became the dominant voice of Christianity. Torah observance is jettisoned completely, and Christian doctrines like the virgin birth become standard, the divinity of Jesus. And what becomes a tremendous embarrassment to the growing church are the relatives and Torah observant disciples of Jesus. These people become a tremendous embarrassment, and therefore they are written out of the story. They are marginalized. What's amazing is that Paul of Tarsus wrote 13 of the 27 books in the Christian Bible. And almost all the other books reflect the philosophy and the teachings of Paul that get read back into the story of Jesus. Now, is it possible at all for us to recover the original muted voice of Jesus himself? And again, scholars believe that this is most accessible to us through his brother James. As I mentioned before, James wrote one of the epistles in the Christian Bible. It's called, of all things, the Epistle of James. And it shouldn't surprise you at all that it is the most neglected, totally neglected, and most unknown of the books in the Christian Bible. You'd be surprised that many, many Christians have no idea that such a book even exists. When the Christian Bible was first being canonized in the period between the 2nd and 6th centuries, there were tremendous controversies over this book of Yaakov, of James. Should we include it? Shouldn't we include it? Very controversial. And Martin Luther, who was the chief architect of the Protestant Reformation, referred to the Epistle of James as the straw epistle. He put it into the back of his edition of the Bible. To him, it was totally irrelevant. Now, why was there such hostility to the Epistle of Paul? To the Epistle of James? Why so much hostility? Number one, James barely mentions much about Jesus, only twice in passing. More importantly, James mentions nothing of any of Paul's doctrines or beliefs or philosophy. James mentions nothing about Jesus' alleged divinity. James mentions nothing about Jesus' sacrificial atoning death on the cross. He mentions nothing about salvation through faith. All of these key ideas in Pauline philosophy are totally absent from the Epistle of James. Secondly, the Epistle of James has a very clear and very strong pro-Torah observant message. It comes out loud and clear in the book of James about the importance of keeping the Torah. And finally, there are many parallels between what is written in the Epistle of James and many of the apocalyptic teachings of both John the Baptizer and Jesus about the kingdom of God being a terrestrial kingdom about to be implemented in this world, not up in heaven. Now, the most dramatic example I can give you of the total marginalization of James, when I first found this, I was shocked beyond belief, was in a book that was published recently by a Jews for Jesus group in Israel. I believe they're from Israel. They're Messianic Jews, and this book is called They Loved the Torah. They Loved the Torah. And the purpose of this book is to try to show, and actually a lot of this book is quite accurate, is to show how Jesus never taught people to abandon the Torah, and how Jesus' followers continue to teach about the importance of the Torah, and how we see from history that the Jewish followers of Jesus continue to observe the Torah. With this, I'm totally happy. He goes to the extent of showing, I believe it's very, very shoddy scholarship, he tries to show even that Paul was pro-Torah. Now, with all of that, you would think that there'd be a whole chapter dedicated to who? To James. James, the head of the Jesus movement. James, who was the one that taught clearly the importance of keeping the Torah. James, who was called James the Tzaddik because of his Torah observance. Not one word about him in this book. That shows you the power of how marginalized from history this James has become. I want to start coming to a conclusion tonight. What are some of the implications of what I've shared with you? Again, the Da Vinci Code tries to tell us that there was a true story of the origins of Christianity that have been concealed. And I believe that on that grounds, the Da Vinci Code is true, except they don't give us the real story. I believe the real story is one that emerges from the texts and from the history and clearly substantiable. And we find that there was a very strange paradox that took place in the early development of the Christian movement. Lutheran minister Jeffrey Butts, who put out a book this year, a very important book called The Brother of Jesus and the Lost Teachings of Christianity. Jeffrey Butts asked the following very poignant question. If the first followers of Jesus, including his own family, were thoroughly Jewish in belief and practice, as opposed to Paul's teachings, then just what is orthodoxy and what is heresy? What is paradoxical is that the original orthodoxy, the original teachings of the Jesus movement, became heresy within the first several hundred years of the growing Gentile Pauline Christian church. All of the Jewish Christian groups are banned as heretics. All their writings are banned and destroyed as heretical writings. It becomes against Christian law to practice the Torah. Paul, in one of his letters, writes against circumcision to the point where he says, I wish those people who were getting circumcised, the knife would slip and they would cut themselves off. That's how rapidly anti-Torah this movement was. James Tabor, who I mentioned before, who again wrote a very important book recently called The Jesus Dynasty, also ponders how it was possible for Christianity, as it developed over the past 2,000 years, to so totally distort its original teachings. There was a famous Jewish preacher who lived about 300 years ago named the Dubner Magid. And the Dubner Magid used to tell little cute stories, and people would wonder, you know, it's so, you tell these little cute stories, you're not really teaching real Torah. What are with these all these stories? He would often talk about why he taught in parables and cute stories. So one of the cute stories he told is the following. He said that there was a man who had a fortune of gold, and he hoarded this fortune under the floorboards of his home. And when he died, everyone thought that he was penniless. They thought he was a pauper. Nothing. So many years later, one of his heirs drops a little coin on the floor, and the coin slipped through the cracks of the floorboards. And he tried to retrieve this little tiny coin, and lifting up the floorboards, he discovers this incredible treasure of gold. So we know that for the rest of his life, he treasured that little coin, because without it, he would never have come to the big pot of treasure. So too, the Dubner Magid said, I tell little parables and cute stories. And sometimes someone might read a cute story in a book, they might read a parable. But the parable might provoke them to deeper study. They might say, hey, this is interesting what this parable, what this story is teaching. I'm going to study more and more and more. And this little cute parable, this little storybook, ultimately leads someone to becoming a great scholar. So Dubner Magid said how much he will cherish that little storybook. For the past year, I've been in correspondence with a man about my age from India. The internet is amazing. And he wrote to me about a year ago. And I wrote back, we've been carrying on this correspondence, and a few weeks ago, I mentioned to him that I'm giving a lecture about the Da Vinci Code. So I want to share with you his email back to me. His name is Jared. And Jared says, though I was a fundamentalist Christian minister, there were several questions for which I have not gotten answers for several years. The Christian theological nature of Jesus had been one big question I could not reckon with, that he was 100% man and 100% divine, and yet he never sinned. And then the inerrancy of the Christian Bible, the fact that it supposedly has no errors and it's perfect, he said, also was a very big question for me, because I could see several contradictions in it. Being so confused, I was searching for answers. During that time last year, my friend, a very staunch fundamentalist Christian, passed on Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code, to me. This book prompted me to an intense and thorough research for many, many weeks of the history of Christianity and its evolution into modern forms. My search led me to a study of Judaism, and finally I became a practicing Noahide, a Ben Noah. I must be very thankful to Dan Brown, he says. Many of us can feel that we're living in very special times. Many great Jewish teachers over the past decades have said that the redemption really is around the corner. And one of the things that happens with the coming redemption is the unfolding of more and more truth in the world. I think it might be possible that this book by Dan Brown could play a significant part in the unfolding, ultimately, of this greater truth in the world. If you go into bookstores today, there are tables on display. If you enjoy the Da Vinci Code, well, we have a whole table full of books for you. And I will tell you, some of those books, not all of them, some of those books are very, very worth studying.
Jews for Judaism hopes that you have found this audio recording to be helpful and informative. Jews for Judaism is an international organization dedicated to countering the multi-million dollar efforts of Christian missionary groups that target Jews, the impact of destructive cults and Eastern religions, and the growing rate of intermarriage that is devastating the Jewish community. Jews for Judaism achieves its goals through one-on-one counseling services and educational programs and materials that connect Jewish people to the spiritual depth, beauty, and wisdom of Judaism. Please contact Jews for Judaism if we can help you. www.jewsforjudaism.ca. Keeping Jews Jewish.